Thank you for showing up. There's a bit of echo in here. That sounds good. Anyway, so let me go to my notes, my sheeting notes. So this presentation is not about system administration. You can fool a lot of people, but you cannot fool a system administrator. So I'm not going to try to do that. Instead, I'm going to give you some insights in the things behind PostFix, give you some idea of how things came to be where they are. This is about the people who run PostFix, large to small, and who provides PostFix. Actually, it's a very small group of people. It's me, one other guy who maintains TLS and a few other pieces, and an occasional volunteer who writes a piece of code. It's there, it's still alive, and it's making progress. I have composed my presentation, as usual, as a short series of episodes, all sort of like little lessons that I learned on my way through PostFix, one about publicity, one about why not write Unix mail, and so on, and so on. There's about 50% of the talk will be historical, and about 50% will be about recent developments. The thing is that you build a mail system that solves a particular problem, and then you think you're done, but the problem changes, and so you have to keep updating your mail system, or it will just slowly over time become irrelevant, and that's not what I want. Okay. Publicity is my first section. If you ever heard me talk about the other program that I worked on in the past, then you will remember that it had a lot of publicity, and this is all free publicity too, and especially in the US, the publicity was not very accurate. But being free, we also didn't have a lot of control about what was being written, and so this was a kind of a wild episode in 1995. And a few years later, we did it different. I was at IBM by then as a visiting scientist, and I had written a program called Secure Mailer, and it was going to be released to the internet, and we arranged with John Markov of New York Times that there would be a section in the New York Times business part of the New York Times. So this is a short quote from those days, and actually the result of this was very different from the result of the previous thing that I showed. You probably know a few things about PostFix. It was initially, the primary goals were something that is more secure, easier to configure, and it has better performance than the competition. And with a bit of effort, I succeeded in doing that. Less known by now is that it was actually meant to be part of a sequel of books that never appeared. One would be about secure programming. The other one was about auditing. And we had one about forensics, and that one actually got published. So over time, you adjust your goals. You lower your levels and until there's something that you can attain. So PostFix was released. There was the publicity in the New York Times, and people were very happy. And after a year or so, I started to notice articles in online and press that mentioned PostFix as something that had changed IBM. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Reportedly, all this started when IBM's top management, Lou Gerstner, was being driven to work. He opens the New York Times and he says, what is this? That's what the official story is. The result was that it actually sped up a lot of developments that were already in motion before. There were a lot of people in IBM who wanted to participate in open source, and they were all struggling to get it done. There was a group that joined the Apache web server project because have realized that IBM's own web server which was a descendant from some ancient open source version, was just too bad to keep alive. So I said, let's just abandon this thing. Let's join the Apache project and we have a really good web server and let's build on that. So that's what they did in 1998. There was a Java compiler open source release. There was a public key infrastructure open source release and they gave it a very cute name, Jonah. And then in end of 98, there was the secure mailer, not such a cool name, source release under the name Postfix. And that time IBM CEO started asking questions. And within a year, IBM had adopted an open source strategy for Linux. And Linux was going to be run on all the systems from small to large. Okay, so that was interesting to see how a very large company can change so quickly in its course with respect to open source. Okay, so that was my first one. The second one is why not, or why write a mail system? And here is a problem. There's a problem here because when you want to improve the world with a piece of software, then you could build something that is really, really great that nobody can use because it doesn't fit in the existing infrastructure. And so the challenge then is you build something that actually has to re-implement something that is broken by design. It's kind of frustrating, but you have to do this because otherwise adoption will be so low. And so the problem with the Unix mail system is that at the time it was like this. You had one or two very large monolithic programs that were running with system privileges and that were doing all kinds of things. They were receiving mail from the network or from local users, and then they would deliver mail to the network, or they would deliver it to a command that you could configure in your .forward file or to a local file. And it would also deliver mail to your mailbox. And the complication with mailboxes is that they were owned by the user, not by the mail system. And so the mail system has to impersonate the recipient. And anyone gives sends mail into the mail system, and then it has to append to my file. That's a privileged operation. And even with sophisticated access control, which Unix didn't have, it is a privileged operation. And the same thing with delivery to a command. If I configure a command in my .forward file, that command had better be executed with my privileges, not the privileges of the mail system. And so again, you have this impersonation problem, and that's all privileged. If you combine large monolithic programs and high privileges, you get a long history of vulnerabilities. I have a few pages here. Note that it's not all sent mail. It's also the bin mail program occasionally showing up in the list of problems. So the problem with these systems is that one mistake can be fatal. One remote client executes a local command as root or appends to any file they choose. With monolithic programs, there are no barriers between the parts, so it's easy to implement. As I will show later, actually that's not true. If you have a large program, it is actually hard to maintain because every time you add to it, you have to worry about all the other parts that might break. It's also very convenient to break into, as we've seen in the past. So with this, I present my Postfix architecture. It's not all my own invention, because there are a lot of principles and ideas in here that that have been tried elsewhere too. But basically, instead of one monolithic system, Postfix is built like an internet router. It has input interfaces on the left-hand side, and each interface has its own encapsulation. Some things have carriage return line feed, like SMTP, and other things have Unix new lines. And on the outgoing side, there are other interfaces for other encapsulations, and they all deliver mail to different things. There's SMTP and LMTP, or mailbox, or other processes like UUCP. I don't know if anybody still uses that, but it is there. So you have this system with input interfaces, output interfaces, and a core that makes routing decisions. And most of the system doesn't need any system privileges at all. But it still needs to be programmed very carefully. People usually worry about SMTP daemons being broken into because people connect to it, but there's no reason why you couldn't do the same thing with the SMTP client. If I can make your system connect to my SMTP server, I can attack your SMTP client and do nasty things. So you really have to be careful with all the different parts of the mail system. Wrapping up this section, there are a couple major influences on how POSIX was built. The first influence is the TIS firewall toolkit, 1993, mostly written by Marcus Rainham. It was a collection of proxies, and one of those things was a very problematic piece of software called ASMAP. And I've struggled with it for several years. It would randomly hang and stop, and then I had to babysit it with another daemon that would kick it, kill it off, and start another one, and it was a troublesome life, and I was glad that I could replace it. But it introduces a lot of things that I have adopted in POSIX, as fixed load privileges, change route jail, an air gap between mail receiving and mail delivering processes. Qmail, of course, has led to, well, POSIX was, among others, written because Qmail existed, and so that's one of them. Qmail has parallel deliveries and mail their file format, which is one message per file. Apache inspired the general implementation of use one process multiple times. It doesn't seem to be such a big deal nowadays with multi-gigahertz CPUs in 8-core or whatever configurations, but being wasteful is not a good thing. Reusing a process multiple times allows you to use it for very, very trivial jobs like asking simple questions instead of forking off a process and killing it. Sendmail, of course, all the interfaces that POSIX provide are inherited from Sendmail because when you want to improve the world, you have to provide something that people can use, and therefore it has to fit into the world that exists before you. And finally, network routers with multiple interface types and encapsulations, but no queue skipping fast path. There is no cheating here. I have to persist the mail before I can continue. A couple notes on POSIX implementation, and let me see how I'm doing time-based at this point. Okay, I can take it a little slower. POSIX implementation. I'm not going to bore you with all the details about how I implemented it, but I want to give you a flavor of the thought process behind some of the parts of POSIX. So I showed you the partitioned architecture, and that was basically knowing that you're going to build a system and knowing that my error rate is 1 in 1,000 lines of code. You'd release a mail system of 20,000 lines of code, you know that you're releasing 20 bugs. And by now, POSIX is 120,000 lines of code if you eliminate comments and stuff like that. So it could be anywhere into the number of 120 bugs in there. And having bugs in software is a fact of life, but you want to do it in a way that it doesn't hurt too much. And so breaking up the system into small pieces is a way of confining the damage from defects. And there are other tricks. Some of them have nothing to do with security, but just with making sure that the system will always work. If a program dies, I just start another one. And if I architect it such that I can do this, then nobody notices that my program crashed. The mail system just keeps going. This one is about optimization. Normally, when you optimize a program, you try to find the pieces that take the most of the time, and they say, I'm going to speed up these pieces, and now my whole system is faster, and that's a good thing. Usually, when you do this, what can happen is that your program has other pieces that are slow, but that's not the problem, because those pieces almost never execute. Now, when you optimize your program too much, there is a strong temptation to improve the parts that run a lot at the expense of the parts that are slow, because they're so slow, but they don't run much. When you're on the internet, you can't really do that, because you don't control how your program will be used. Well, you know maybe how it's used now, but tomorrow or next year, usage patterns actually change. And so all your optimizations for speeding up this part at the expense of that part actually come back and bite you. And I have a few examples here. For example, Postgres was designed to deliver mail very fast. And that's by itself a good thing. But it's not really optimal when 90% of the mail is spam. You don't really want to deliver to be the fastest mail system that delivers all the spam into people's inbox. You want to actually build a system that only delivers good mail fast and that does something else with the other mail. I also found out that I was making an optimistic assumption in the implementation of the SMTP daemon. I assumed that spam clients and other mail clients don't waste time. They connect to your server, they try to deliver their goods, and then they go away so they can go to the next victim. And a few years ago, the early version of the Storm botnet had a bug where it would connect to an SMTP server, and the server would say, go away. And then the zombie would just do nothing until RFC 821 says, thou shalt wait for 5 minutes before timing out the client. And this was not really a good situation. So again, it's an optimization that, it's an assumption that is that suddenly becomes a problem, because normally this never happens, so it wasn't a problem. Now the worst case becomes a normal case, and it dominates your performance. And finally, don't improve the common case. What I learned is don't improve the common case. Actually, improve the worst cases first. Make sure that the worst cases aren't too bad. And the biggest mistake that I made was actually improve, optimize the performance at the cost of the user interface. I'll show you an example and also how I fixed it. When I started work on Postgres, one of my colleagues mentioned, how hard can it be? All you need to do is implement SMTP without screwing up. It's not hard. SMTP has only 4 or 5 commands, mail to, hello, recipient to, data, dot, quit. it's not a big deal. And so optimistically, I started work on this, and I slowly realized that I had gotten myself into trouble, because actually mail systems do a lot of things. They implement all kinds of protocols, SMTP, DNS, TLS, LDAP, SQL, MILTER. LDAP and SQL are not really mail protocols, but if you want to build a system that people can actually use, then it has to integrate with other systems, and then you have to provide that too. So you end up with a Tower of Babel kind of language confusion. There's also the problem of broken implementations. So SMTP is a simple protocol. I implemented it with the RFC on one and typing in the commands of the other, and I tested my program against itself, and yep, it works. I mean, it works. And then I tested it against other programs, and it didn't work. It's the problem that other people don't read RFCs as carefully as they should. And so your mail system may work by the book, but if you can't talk with other mail systems, then it's not useful. Mailbox databases are complicated. There are all kinds of problems, as other syntax, queue management, and of course, spam, virus, and spoofing, and DKIM and sender ID. So all those things make implementing a mail server a little bit more complicated than initially expected. So how do you do this? Usually the solution is make it not my problem, and that's more or less what I did. So I decided I'm going to build a mail system. This is a little bit of revisionist history, but basically I didn't want to build all that other stuff. I didn't want to build antivirus software. I didn't want to build all those mail authentication protocols. I certainly didn't want to build SPF into Postgres. So make it not my problem, but provide a way that people could actually plug those things into Postgres. The other principle is also that I don't make my own clothes, I don't make my own shoes, and I don't build my own house. I actually let other people do those things, and they usually do a better job than I do. and again here, by putting safe extension mechanisms into PostFix, I could let other people build better antivirus systems than I could ever do, or better SPF implementations than I ever would. And finally, one of the things was a more or less safe C programming API. I didn't really want to implement PostFix in C, but this was the first stage of a development where I was going to do it in C, figure out what the problem was, and then the next step, which never happened, was going to be something better. But in the meantime, I had to live on C and its shortcomings. So, very simple example, 80-column punch cards are obsolete. Problem with fixed buffers is that they're always too small or too large and almost never right. It's like a clock. It clock that stands still has the right time only twice a day. Dynamic buffers were found to be, well, if fixed buffers are bad, then dynamic buffers are good, right? I mean, it's not bad, so it must be good. And my colleague, Doug Shales, reviewed one of those many fixes for the IBM HTTPD server for, in this case, a buffer overflow, and somebody carefully implemented a dynamically allocated input routine. And Doug said, okay, let's test this thing. And so he just sent in an unlimited string of inputs. And he watched as the HTTPD slowly keeled over and died after running the whole machine out of virtual memory. So that was not good. And I tested something similar later with Qmail at a time when resource limits were not really implemented or enforced, and experienced the same thing. That led to a worse relationship with Bernstein than I had before. Nowadays, all OSs actually have non-zero resource limits, and they will enforce them, and so it's not so easy to run your system out of virtual memory anymore, as it was when I started work on PostFix. What I learned from this is when you use dynamic buffers, you shall still put sanity checks on the size of things, and also take precautions that you're not going to accumulate an endless collection of dynamically allocated objects, because eventually you will run out of memory. And the last thing you want with a mail system is that it lets you down when you need it most, namely when you have a lot of traffic. You don't want a mail system that just uses more and more memory as the load on the system increases. It should just stay under some bound and just keep working, getting the mail out of the system instead of dying. Okay. Let's see how we're doing. All right. Very good. So now I'm going into a little bit more detail of how I added things to PostFix that I didn't want to build myself. As you probably know, I'm a Unix guy, and I was very happy building stuff in Unix, TCP wrapper, Satan, Cornus Toolkit, PostFix, and I didn't really worry much about viruses on Windows and DOS PCs until the time came that email was the main distribution channel for worms and viruses for Windows PCs. That was not so nice. A short-term fix was to add a regular expression mechanism to PostFix. This was from Lamont Jones. You may know his name from Debian Linux as a maintainer of several parts. The idea was if you could just put in a regular expression rule that says, oh, if it starts with subject and it has an important message from something, then reject it because it is almost certainly Melissa mail trying to get into your system. And of course, this is not really a permanent solution because you can't really reject mail that has important message from foo. In the end, you will have real mail that gets caught in these things. But for when, you know, when the fire comes out in big flames, you need to do something to keep the fire under control, and this is a reasonable thing to do. For the longer term, the solution was to delegate deep inspection to other people. Let other people do a better job. There was a problem with integration. People were implementing specialized protocols, content vectoring protocol. I don't know if it still exists. Milter was coming up and a couple others. And I didn't really like the idea of building my own version of my own protocol or some ad hoc protocol that was only useful for one thing. I don't like unitaskers. So I decided that SMTP was good enough for receiving mail across the whole internet. Therefore, it should be good enough for sending mail from Postix into a content filter. And that's mostly true. There are a couple limitations. You don't really know directly what client the mail is coming from. It's a little harder. But generally, this works very well. And so conceptually, this is how it works. You have the network. Mail goes into POSIX, and it goes into a queue. And so it comes in from the network at one rate, and it goes from POSIX from the queue into the content filter at some other rate, because network and filters, they all have different speeds and latencies. And once it comes out of the filter, it goes back into POSIX, and then POSIX decides where it's going to deliver, to a mailbox or some inside back end exchange server or whatever. So this is the general concept. You have an MTA before and after the filter. Red is dirty, green is clean. And this is really simple. But it can't be that simple, right? Because it's too simple. And also, using two mail systems must be wasteful. But this is at least the concept, and the concept works very well. You have a good performance matching. If mail trickles in from the network, hundreds of connections at the same time, you can actually feed it through the filter with a few, like 10 connections or so. And it will nicely keep up. And if there is a spike of mail on the incoming side, it will just buffer up in your queue, and then it goes out, and there's no harm done. There's no overload happening. There's a disadvantage that if you receive mail before you filter it, then you cannot return bad mail to the sender. If you return bad mail to the sender, then you're going to annoy a lot of innocent people, because mail, like spam, usually doesn't have a real sender address. It has just somebody's sender address, and they didn't send it. So when you have an architecture like this, you cannot reject mail, you need to discard it or quarantine it. And quarantine is like discarding, except with a time lag, because effectively you're discarding it later. The problem with discarding mail was unexpected. European people, there are lots of countries in Europe where you cannot discard mail. Well, if it's mail that I receive on my own machine, I can do whatever I want with it. But if you like an ISP or some other provider, you take responsibility for the mail if you receive it, and then you cannot throw it away. And so there was pressure to fix that. In the meantime, I mentioned that using two mail systems was wasteful, and that it was too simple. And so the first implementation of Postix content filters was a bit of a mistake. It was an optimization at the cost of the user interface, because this is what happens here is it's one mail system that handles one message twice. So it comes in from the network, it is read, and it goes through the queue. It goes out with an SMTP client to a content filter. And then it's clean, and it comes back via a different SMTP server. It goes through the queue again, and then it goes out as clean mail. And this just confuses people no end. And so and you can imagine how hard troubleshooting is. If you have a congested queue, my mail queue is big, and then you need to know, where is the mail going to? Well, it's one queue that is handling both clean and dirty mail. So it's really hard to find out. After a few years, I have gone back to this model. After we found a nice way to implement multiple postfix instances as one, that really simplifies management. Now you have two queues. Now you can inspect. You can see which one is full and which one is congested, and not worry about one configuration file actually impersonating two different mail systems. That's just too hard. Okay. So to respond to the Europeans, where they had the problem of, well, I must filter the mail before I take responsibility for it, because I cannot throw it away. And so the solution was to actually build a backdoor in my SMTP daemon that gives it to the filter while the SMTP session is still open. And then the filter filters it, and it gives it to the SMTP server, another SMTP server behind it, and then it goes into the mail queue. This is this works. People like it. It gives what you call this instant gratification. You can tell the spammer, I don't like your mail, while they're still connected. Whereas if you filter after you queue it, you can't tell the spammer that you hate his guts. So you reject bad mail before it goes into the queue. The problem is that if you have it in the session, then you have one content filter process, or actually a bunch of processes for one filter, per SMTP session, and that gets pretty expensive because they suck up memory like there is no tomorrow. I was able to do a speed matching trick where the first SMTP server received the mail in its entirety, and then once it receives the mail in its entirety, finds a free content filter, gives it to the filter, and the filter filters it quickly. And thereby, I can reduce the number of filter processes by 40% or so and keep the system operable. Okay. The second part about adding things is, again, about not inventing things. I should actually have put a big recycle symbol on my POSIX presentation. It's mostly about reusing stuff that works and avoiding to invent things, because, you know, if you build a new thing, people like you have to learn how to use it, whereas if I use something that exists, then you're already familiar with it, and it's less work for me and less work for you. So in this case, this was by 2005. There was a lot of development of anti-spoofing technologies, SPF, sender ID, domain keys, domain DKIM, and a bunch of other that are harder to pronounce. And by now the end is coming into sight, but in 2004 it definitely wasn't. And building everything into POSIX just wasn't practical, especially because a lot of these protocols were still evolving, and putting all that stuff into POSIX is not a good idea. It turns out that a lot of Linux distributions and other distributions usually run a POSIX versions from two or three releases ago. Red Hat is on POSIX version 2.5, POSIX 2.7 was released early this year, and so there's this time lag between I put something into POSIX and the time that it actually hits the masses of people who need it. And therefore, if I build something into POSIX, it will be obsolete, and the protocol will have been revised by the time people actually get to use it. So that's not a good idea. So the solution here was look at other implementations of these protocols, and it turned out that there was a large collection of sendmail mail filters that already did these things. And I thought, well, let's do that. I was asked if I was willing to build sender ID into POSIX, and I thought, well, let's try to stay out of this problem and instead implement something that will allow people to plug in sender ID, and then they can do the other things too. So that's what I ended up doing. Milter was relatively stable, well understood, with all its limitations. And then the horror story is, how do you build Milter into PostFix? Milter is originates from SendMail. SendMail is a monolithic mail system. There's everything in one program. And Milters are programs that are connected via a socket to the SendMail application. And so SendMail sends little bits of protocol information, such as connect, ALO, mail, sender, recipient, data, and then the headers and the body if the Milter wants them. And if you do this with PostFix, PostFix is like 40 different daemons all doing different things, then part of the session has to be handled by one PostFix daemon, the SMTP server, and then there's another program in Orange that actually puts mail into the queue, and then it has to talk with the Milter application because it is doing things like headers and bodies. And so handing over things and back and forth is kind of challenging, but it was definitely doable, and the reward was good. Once I had nailed this, it took a few bug fixes to get it really solid down. It has been working pretty well now for several years, and it's most of the important things have been the applications for Milter have been they know the little differences between PostFix and SendMail, so they actually work. In the beginning, I had to jump hoops to make them believe that they were talking to SendMail, but now they know the difference and it's okay. So that was the heroic effort of building Milter protocols into PostFix, and there was a little bit of a surprise a year or so later when I actually received a SendMail Innovation Award. This was on the occasion of SendMail's 25th birthday. They held a few parties, one in Mountain View that I missed, one in London that I attended, and one in Tokyo. And they gave awards to a few people who had done something that was important in some way or another. And I got one for extending Milter functionality to PostFix, and there was also a release, a PR release, that PostFix was going to be supported by SendMail. I said, oh, nice. Speaking of SendMail, so initially when PostFix was released, it was a pretty small, minimal mail system, just about the same size and functionality as Qmail. But over time, I realized that it was not complete. There were things that needed to be added, and I should have added the slide here that has the line count of RFCs over time. It starts with 500 lines of RFCs. That's just SMTP, RFC 822, the mail, the message header, and body format, and something else. So this is really a minimal mail system. But to make it useful, you have to understand enough of MIME that you can properly handle that, and instead of sending everybody their own non-standard bounce message that totally corrupts attachments, implementing standard delivery notifications. All those things add up to the bulk of the mail system. So MIME was just about as much RFC text as all the rest of the mail system before that I had. And then it comes in bigger chunks. So, initial trigger was that as I was cleaning out my archives of tarballs, I noticed that the PostFix tarball was larger than the SendMail tarball. I thought, And then a few weeks later, I got email from Marcus Rainham, and he, in less diplomatic terms, asked if I had dragged in an XML parser into PostFix. I said, no, that's not the problem. It's different. I took contemporary versions of SendMail and PostFix and the latest Qmail release and did some normalization. I wanted to see what these three systems solve similar problems, so therefore the size of their source code is something that you can compare. The only problem was that formatting of source code differed widely between some of these mail systems. So I reformatted them to K and R, C, like God created it, and stripped the comments away and did some simple things. And then I ended up with shrinking POSIX by 45% and expanding QML by 25%. Anyway, so you really have to do these things if you want to compare line counts, because otherwise you're really doing silly things. This is just silly, otherwise it's really silly. So this is the graph of POSIX over time. As you see, POSIX take off as an alpha release about 20,000 lines, and it's 24 beta release. That's the first public release, 1998. And then it steadily goes up. Something like 8,000 lines a year or so, until 2006, where with some hint from my management, I declare POSIX complete. This is also why that release was later in the year, because I must finish POSIX, so I just, normally I release it in January, February, March, first quarter, but, you know, this is, I have to finish it now. So this went on until July, I think. And then I declared POSIX complete, and to prove that it was really complete, I also, you notice that the slope of POSIX goes down to almost half of the initial slope, and this is to show that it's really done now. I'm just squeezing more functionality in the smaller lines of code, smaller number of lines. Working a little harder to get things out. What else can I say about this? Well, you see, so it's at 120,000 lines or so. The emphasis is now more on maintaining the things that work and just updating things that need to be updated because of RFC rot or API rot, where somebody decides that the link system call suddenly shall behave in a different way, whereas it has behaved perfectly okay for the last 40 years or so. So that's the work mostly in that part. Next year it will go up a little bit more. The main reason why POSIX didn't become a bloated mess is because it is a bunch of small programs. And my claim is that small programs are easier to maintain. Of course, you first have to put in all the communication infrastructure that allows small programs to work together. So once you make that investment, which is not completely non-trivial, then it is easier to maintain small programs, because what I end up doing is, if it's a small feature, I modify a small program. It's not too hard, not too bad. It's, you know, small program does only so many things. I change this part here, and I don't have to worry at all about breaking something else in the mail system. If it's a major feature, then it's usually worthy of a new program and a little protocol, that a very narrow little protocol that will talk to the rest of the mail system. And if you don't need the new feature, then the new program never runs. And programs that don't run don't crash. They don't have all kinds of problems. The current breakdown of POSIX is 24 daemons and 13 commands. And the number of ones that actually run with privileges hasn't really changed over time at all. It's just all the other stuff that has increased over time. But I have to confess, small is a relative term. By now, the SMTP daemon is almost 10,000 lines, you know, KNR formatted, comments stripped, and that's about half the size of the alpha release of POSIX. So it's small is a relative thing. I don't claim that the programs are really small. Would be nice if they could, but yeah. Okay. How are we doing here? 43. Good. Market share. A very short section on market share. If you want to find out how many people use POSIX or some other mail system, there are many different ways to find out. One of them is you just port scan the whole internet. Well, actually, this is how I found DNS servers inside of IBM, because you don't really know where they are. So I just port scanned all of IBM very carefully. But if you port scan all of the internet, port 25, and see if something responds and what it is, and you try to figure out from the responses, then the result you get is a lot of almost irrelevant machines, like Joe's laptop, or things like that. It's not necessarily meaningful for what is really carrying the load of the mail on the internet. And other people, they just connect to the front gate. And that's the study that was done here. This is a study by people who had developed an email security product, and they wanted to find out where are my potential customers. And their potential customer is not your laptop. It's companies that have internet-facing gateways. And so they obtained a list of 500,000 domain names, and then they port scanned just those domains to find out what kind of mail server is running on the corporate gateway of these companies. And they found out that... So this is 2007, measurements done end of 2006, that SendMail and POSIX were having the largest share, taking into account that there was 50% that they couldn't really figure out what it was. But they tried very hard. If you look at the article, they don't just look at the banner. They actually talk to the server, they send invalid commands, and they look at the error response, and then they figure out what the mail system is. So you have to, they did a more thorough job than just looking at banners. And so the 15% could be anything, but then POSIX and SendMail are, at that time, the largest share, and then a lot of smaller shares from other things. Names, interesting. So Postini is now owned by somebody else. And a lot of names are either changed or changed ownership or whatever. So by this metric, POSIX is actually serious in size. Around the same time, somebody did a Google Trends query. Google Trends is you type words in, and it will tell you how often people search for those words. And so with a little bit of imagination, if you type SendMail, POSIX, QMail, XIM, you get an indication of how often people ask Google about SendMail, POSIX, QMail, or XIM. And this was a few years ago. Meanwhile, I have repeated the measurement to make it recent. And but you see that the SendMail and POSIX lines are crossing somewhere around 2006 or 7. And the problem with measurements like this is that the search queries may not be about mail systems. Postfix is a very generic word. There's prefix, postfix, infix. And I have a slide that I am not showing where I just ask for those three and then you see something. XIM is, as it turns out, an acronym for export-import bank, and lots of countries have export-import banks. And so the word XIM shows up in contexts that have nothing to do with email. Right, that's a second order Google. And so to find out what, you know, you can tweak your query, make it sure that it's about mail systems, and you do them silly things like SendMail server, POSIX server, and you still see that the lines are crossing, so maybe it's something there. We'll never know. With things like this, it's really nice to just put in the name of your company or your school and the other company or the other school and see how they are doing in mindshare. The answers that you get are also always only as good as the questions that you ask. And in the case of name collisions, the word may be used in a completely different context than the one you have in mind, and so the numbers could be really off. And that I also notice, if you look at these graphs, you see that they're going down. this means that as they go down, the proportion of people on the internet that ask questions about mail systems is going down too. So only a minority of users is interested in email, and their proportion is going down. So just to remember our place in this world. Okay. Current developments. The remainder of my talk is about how I have picked up POSIX development after a few years because I realized that the world is changing. And to make sure that the mail system remains viable, I have to add another layer of protection. Zombies suck the life out of the mail server, as it says here. So this development actually started summer previous year for a few weeks so I could present a talk at a presentation. And then I resumed this this summer so I could talk at this conference. So the numbers I have now are up to date. The development has continued. And so changes in threats. You remember in 1999, I had this mail system that was running on Windows, so I didn't have to worry about PC viruses, and then suddenly it was doing a lot of... it was very involved with distribution of those things. And the solution there was to outsource the problem to external content filters that I didn't have to write. In 2009, I had this a different problem. I have a mail system. It really has world-class performance. But the world-class performance is spending almost all its resources not delivering mail. I mean, that's talk about a optimization mismatch. You optimize for this problem, but it's really doing something else. In this case, the final solution is working smarter. And so this is really the problem. I have this from Message Labs Intelligence Report from August 2010. So these people are in the business of selling email security, and so they make things. They have a business of making things look bad. So the numbers are scary. 92% of mail, it's still going up. 92% of mail is spam, and 95% of spam is from botnets. It was 90% of mail is spam earlier in the year, and less than 90% of spam was from botnets. Things fluctuate, but my expectation is that things will get worse for a while before they get better. So the portion of mail that you actually might want to receive is only this little tiny green sliver. And that's what I optimized POSIX for initially. This other part, I have to deal with because it is slowly overwhelming systems. What happens is that all these zombies on the internet are keeping SMTP server ports busy, and they're getting in the way of mail that you want to receive. So roughly sketched, on the left-hand side are connections that are queued in the kernel. Lots of zombies and an occasional legitimate connection. They're all queued in the kernel. And on the right-hand side are the connections that are actually handled by POSIX. They have passed the accept system call. And that's only 100 or so, depending on your mail system, how it's configured. And that means that when this happens a lot, mail systems have to wait in the kernel. And they might time out before they even get service. And that means delays for legitimate mail. I mean, I don't care about what happens to the zombies, but your legitimate mail gets delayed. And the worst case was with the Storm botnet. I mentioned it in the introduction. Storm, a large botnet, had a bug. The SMTP, it has an SMTP client. It connects to an SMTP server. The server says, go away. And then the client becomes confused, and it doesn't know what it should do. So it just sits there until the 5-minute timeout form RFC 5321 nowadays says, OK, now you can let it go. Because this is ridiculous. You can't really spend 5 minutes timing out on these things, because there's, you will never have enough SMPP daemon processes to do this. So there are several things here that you can do to deal with the problem. Again, there is the short-term fix and there's the long-term fix. The short-term fix is overload is temporary. You say, okay, well, it's a temporary overload. I can deal with it. I just reduce my timeouts and I reduce a few other things. And it's nice if POSIX can do this automatically. And so that's what I will explain next. But for persistent overload, you know, the zombie problem gets worse and worse. You need something that can actually keep the zombies away from the mail system so you don't have to deal with this overload in the way that it is now. Of course, the alternative is that you just get a forklift and throw more hardware at the problem, but I try to work smarter. So this is the work faster scenario, temporary overload. Spend less time, reduce time limits, and also after one or two errors, like a non-existent recipient or something, hang up and give the SMTP port to somebody else. This will delay some legitimate mail, but given that you're not receiving any mail at all anyway, this is still better than not receiving it. So you will see less mail from sites that have a really poor network connection that is very congested or that is really far away, or they have some other problem in their network infrastructure that introduces lots of delays or packet loss. So that mail will just not get past your timeouts, and they will have to try later when the load is gone. There are also mailing list managers that send mail with relatively short timeouts because they have to reach hundreds of thousands of recipients, and they can't do that if they have 5-minute timeouts. So they go down to 10-second timeouts or less, and those systems might not get through your time limits either. But still, it's better to receive a large portion of mail than no mail at all. But this kind of thing you can only afford when the overload is temporary. The only problem at the time was this was after POSIX was declared complete, and I didn't really have a lot of time, and I was working on other things. So I had to implement the whole thing in a few lines of code. And so the name stress is both for the mail systems and for myself. There's a configuration parameter that is called stress, and it is yes or not. And if it is yes, the SMTPD timeout is only 10 seconds, and otherwise it's the 300 seconds that the RFC wants you to use. And there's a hard error limit, how many commands can a client send that have a negative response. Under stress, I just hang up after the first error, and otherwise they can make 20. And this is automatically toggled by a POSIX super server daemon process that watches the number of SMTP sessions. When it hits the limit, it sets this configuration parameter. And when the overload is gone for 15 minutes or so, it will turn it off again. So this deals with the temporary overload problem. But if the zombie problem gets worse, then we need a more viable solution that doesn't have these negative side effects. And so you can either work harder with more hardware, or you can work smarter. Keep the zombies away from the mail server. This means that you put something in front of the mail server that actually talks to the zombies first and then decides, you're a zombie, go away. And this way, more SMTP server processes stay available for legitimate mail. So this is conceptually what happens. There's a program called Post Screen. It takes all the connections from the network, and it decides if something is a zombie or not. And if it's not a zombie, then it may talk to the mail system. And this way, currently 90% or so of the connections to my mail system just don't go to my mail system anymore. It makes my log files a lot smaller. But of course, you have to design this really conservatively because there is no way back. Once you've rejected the mail, it's not coming again. Zombies are blacklisted in only a few hours. Zombies have a very limited time life. They have a few hours where they can send all their spam, and once they're blacklisted, they're dead. And this means that zombies are in a real hurry to send email. And so whereas in the previous solution where POSIX was overloaded and it was trying to shorten timeouts and so on, and POSIX was under stress, now I'm turning the tables around. The zombie is in a hurry, but Postgres isn't. It just very slowly goes through the SMTP session and just makes life miserable for the zombie. When clients are in a hurry to send mail, they cut corners in the protocol implementation. They talk before their turn. They send multiple commands at the same time, and they do a couple other things that are relatively easy to detect and that normal mail systems don't do. So this is things that that work to recognize zombies. Zombies also are trying to be smart. Early implementations would just connect to a site and just hammer the server and thereby set off lots of false alarms and they would be useless within a short time. Nowadays, zombies don't spam the same site repeatedly. They try to avoid doing that, so they try to fly under the radar. And so for Postgres to work, it actually has to make a decision based on the first connection, because the client might never come back. And for those things, if it's not making one of those protocol violations, I have to rely on DNS. DNS blacklists and whitelists, they're kind of a shared intelligence resource. Other people have already found out that this is a zombie, and now I can use the DNS to keep it away. So that's a combination of things that I'm using here to get my zombies out of my mail system. So the implementation, the workflow is a fast path and a slow path. The fast path is a fraction of a millisecond. Accept a connection. Look in a temporary whitelist. If the IP address is in the whitelist, hand it off to a real SMTP daemon, and this happens in a fraction of a millisecond. So for most mail, there is no delay. If you're a stranger, then it looks in a local whitelist. If it's a local appliance or something that doesn't implement SMTP completely properly, then it needs to be whitelisted. If it's on a DNS white or blacklist, then that's all another thing, and then there are the protocol checks. If all those things work out okay, then the client is added to the temporary whitelist, and it goes to the SMTP server. So the next time it connects, it gets the fast path treatment. If it fails all the tests, then the mail is ejected, and the client is disconnected. But the slow path can take up to 6 seconds. So this is making life a little miserable for zombies that are in a hurry, because Postgres has all the time that it can take. I mean, if you use large times, of course, you end up holding lots of sockets open, but that's not a big deal. I'll give you one example of a protocol check that turns out to detect zombies relatively well. This is zombies that speak before their turn. So normally, SMTP, the server speaks first, and then the client speaks. This is not like HTTP, but this is like the old protocols like FTP and SMTP. So the server greets first, and then the client says, hello, I am this and this. In SendMail, there is a feature called greet pause where the mail system says nothing for 5 or 10 seconds, and then you wait if the client starts talking. And it doesn't really work very well. I tested it in Postfix. Very few clients will actually start to talk. More clients will just go away and give up. So that's a very time-consuming way of finding out if something is a zombie. it also relies on manual whitelisting, so you're really delaying lots of clients that shouldn't be punished. I don't know if you have dog catchers in the US, but if you want to find out if the house has a dog because it needs to pay for a license or something, you know, there are countries where you need to pay taxation for your dog, and then it gets a little medallion to show that it has been paid. But then, of course, you need to enforce this, and so you go after, find out if people have a dog that they didn't pay for. And how do you find out if the house has a dog? You can just wait and listen, but that could take a while. The other is you just ring the bell, and it will bark immediately. And so I'm doing something along the same lines with Postfix, Postscreen. How do we find out if something is a zombie? Well, you say something, but you say it in a special way. So to make the zombie bark, I exploit multi-line feature in SMTP. If the server opens the connection with a multi-line greeting, the client is supposed to start talking after all those lines have been sent. However, if the server only sends part of the multi-line greeting and the client starts talking immediately, then this is a good sign that it is a zombie. And it works out pretty well. It's like ringing the bell and listen for the dog. To show you how well it works, this is for a site in Germany, in Berlin. I have to rely on other people for these measurements because my own domain gets only very few emails. I have only 2 users on my site. So the mail volume is not really good enough to learn about these things. This is a academic medical campus in Berlin. Berlin is a nice big city, so they get some spam. And when you try this trick, you see that over time, the pre-greets actually are nicely organized by distance to the client. Russia and Ukraine are pretty close to Germany, and so they speak first. Then there's the USA, is a little farther away. India and Brazil are about the same distance, again farther away, and so on. So you see all these peaks, depending on where the client is, it will speak before its turn, and you see a nice peak of things. So this is for a different site, python.org in Amsterdam. Basically the same idea, but it already shows that different sites actually have a different mix of spam coming to them. So here you have some mail from Belarus and Kazakhstan, whereas the other one doesn't. And these are the most spamming clients for those systems. But otherwise, it's basically the same idea. You see a peak at approximately where you should expect it. So, to conclude my talk with a few more results, the spam load is different for different sites, as you might expect. And it's also different at different times of day. I hadn't really realized that it was so much variation in there, but turns out that a lot of spam bots are only running during daytime, and they are turned off in the night. So you see these. If you plot the spam flow by country, and you get these bumps that peak in the day, usually in the afternoon, and that go down in the night. It also turns out that spam is sent a little later than ham. So ham is sent earlier in the morning, and spam is sent later in the evening. But this is the mix of spam for the two sites that I had my pilots running. One is python.org, and the other is caritate.de, the medical center in Berlin. As you see, the number of connections this is a small site still. It's 100,000 a day or so. Brazil, Russia, and India are dominant in both cases, but then it gets a little different. When you look at the time distribution, it's actually was a little bit surprised for me. You see, Brazil sends most of its day in the evening, when it's evening in Berlin, whereas Russia sends it in the afternoon and India sends it in the morning. But so those countries all have this pattern where most of the spam is sent in one part of the day, which is middle of the day their time. Whereas China and US have this almost, well, don't have this dramatic variation between time of day. So there's the way that mail is sent from China and US is really different from these other countries. I have to figure out what the difference means. And maybe tell you about that later. Okay. So Postkin is the recent development in Postix. It's going to be released in the next Postix release early next year. It has a couple features like weighted DNS blocklist lookup and whitelist lookup. I have some pilot results for small sites with up to 200,000 connections a day. It shows that the pre-greeters are about, well, 10% of the pre-greeters are actually not on DNS blocklist, so it's mildly useful. Pipelining, the way some clients send multiple commands at the same time, is actually very rare. So there's no good use for deep protocol checks at this time because they just don't catch anything. I will expect to add other protocol tests over time. As zombies become more RFC compliant, they will have other mistakes and there will be ways to detect them. This also means that I have to start planning for extension interfaces because I don't want to build everything. Plus, if I release it now, it's going to be deployed worldwide 2 years from now. And so there needs to be a way of updating the software without changing the binary. Conclusion. After 12 years of Postfix, which is a long time, good PR does make a difference. I never expected that PR, the New York Times business section article, would have such an impact on IBM. The second one is don't reinvent. If a protocol works or some other interface works, use it. People are familiar with it. They understand how it fails. And they don't have to learn new tricks. Invent sparingly. The stable protocols definitely built into the system because you don't really want to be in a situation that you have to find plugins for almost everything to make the system usable. So the stable protocols built into the system and plugins for all the stuff that is still evolving. And eventually, I expect that Deakin might be part of Postix, but it's still... I'm on the mailing list, and people are still bitching about details of what Deakin actually is and what it is not, and what it means, and how you should use it, and why not, and why well. So until those things are settled, it's maybe not such a good idea to build it all into the mail system. Plugins for future proofing. I can release Postix now, but it takes 2 years before it reaches other people, and so by that time, they must be able to make their system up to date by plugging in whatever the current version is of things. I learned that optimization, I did optimize for worst cases in Postix because I was really aware that you know, the world changes, but there were a couple surprises where it was worse than I thought it was going to be, like 5-minute timeouts in SMTP. I didn't expect that that it would actually be a real problem in real life, but it turned out to be that the Storm Zombie botnet was triggering this massively worldwide. And finally, the lesson that I would like to have learned is don't let a C prototype become your final implementation. Unfortunately, the C prototype is what I will be stuck with. There will be no time to replace it by what I wanted to build, but such is life. Okay, final conclusion. Yes, extensibility, I've hammered a lot about that, so I won't talk about extensibility again, but it gives users more choice. they don't have to get everything from one place. And the last one, the battle continues. I was concerned that that the architecture that I have was good for the network when it was created, but not for the network that is populated by zombies that do 90% of the mail volume. So by filtering the connections in a safe way, I hope that I can keep the mail system operable for the next 10 years or so. But we'll see about that. Okay, well, that's it. And there is time for questions. That's a good question. So the idea, yeah, what language would I use? My original plan was to do the same thing that I had done with some other projects before, and that was implement a language, a safe language in C, but then you would configure the system in this safer language. I had done that with a couple things. And that worked out very well because it's not like Perl, because Perl is too powerful, but like a simplified version of a Perl-like language, where you don't have things that are dangerous, but enough to make the system useful. So a powerful configuration language implemented in an engine of C, but you wouldn't have C for everything. And that was the idea. And but that means that I had to first understand enough of the problem. And to understand enough of the problem, I had to build something that handled at least mail from and to the network and local delivery and local submission. And by that time, I had finished half a year. And it was almost, and I had just time enough to finish it for the beta release for people so they could start using it. So that was a miscalculation, I guess. But that's what I wanted to do. Do a safe configuration language, very powerful enough that you can actually describe the flow of mail and not have to do most of the things in C.
On a sort of related note, I've always thought that the hallmark of a successful programming system is not so much how easy it is to extend as how easy it is to throw things out. On one hand, over the life of PostFix, have you actually had the opportunity to remove anything? And whether you have or not, do you feel that building the system out of cooperating little pieces makes that easier or harder? Probably not so much technically, because technically it's obviously easier, but sort of culturally.
Well, in principle, I can throw things out because it's a loosely coupled system. Let's see, it's... Well, there are a couple things that have happened. One is... LMTP is a protocol that is similar to SMTP. It's almost the same. But at some point, somebody forked the SMTP client into an LMTP client. And they evolved separately for several years. And at some point, it was just too much trouble to maintain both programs. And we forcefully merged those into one. So that was sort of eliminating a program. There is a very rudimentary, there is no others rewriting language in PostFix at all. It has a table lookup interface for almost everything. So you use tables for access maps, and for address mappings, for routing, for who knows what. And if it is simple strings, you just use BurkeDB tables, and it will do the job. If it's tricky, use regular expressions, which are not a great user interface, but they will do almost anything. It's harder to use. So I still have notes about an address rewriting language, but the idea of a trivial rewrite, which is one of the demons in POSIX, was that I was going to substitute. This was going to be a prototype for a real rewrite, which will probably never be written. As for whether it's one program or many programs, that's hardly an issue. You have to build something anyway. You have to build an API to talk to it in one way or the other. And if the API is message passing based under the covers, who knows? I don't think it really matters. I'm not passing pointers from one process into another anyway. So next, and that may very well account for some of the stability that POSIX has. That's about all I can say off the hand. Thank you. Thanks for the question. Another question? No more questions?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.